Another wall today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Mexico and the United States have a new trade deal to replace NAFTA. Canada is not part of it yet. And that's a problem given how integrated Canada is economically with the U.S. and Mexico.
We have over $1 trillion of annual trade between the three partners. You know, if you think of it as like a supply chain running through the three countries, it's almost as if you're putting a wall up between the United States and Canada in the middle of that factory.
But don't look to Canada to make easy concessions now.
It certainly is nothing that will stampede or intimidate the Canadians.
Plus, Serena Williams' superhero suit has been banned from future French Opens, but this reporter doesn't think it will affect the way Williams plays.
You can't take the superpowers away from the superhero. You can take her suit, you can't take the powers away.
Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thanks for being here. It was a big day for trade, President Trump announced yesterday as he sat down in the Oval Office and proceeded to dial his Mexican counterpart Enrique Peña Nieto for a congratulatory call.
I believe the president is on the phone. Enrique?
Awkward moment. Hey, we're in radio. We get it. It's common to not connect when you're making an overseas phone call. But let's also point out that this is why there are diplomats and assistants in the government to set up these important calls when the president says there's a big day in trade.
President Trump, how are you? Good morning.
Thank you, Enrique, and congratulations. That's really fantastic.
Trump and Peña Nieto did manage to speak, and in a tone warmer than they have in the past. So this is the U.S.-Mexico trade agreement. Some ta is harder to say than NAFTA. Canada is not in the deal, not yet. Inu Manak is a visiting scholar at the Cato Institute. So can you give us an overview of some of the updates to NAFTA that the U.S. and Mexico have agreed to?
So right now, we know a little bit about what was agreed to by the U.S. and Mexico based on some fact sheets that the United States trade representative posted on their website yesterday afternoon. Some of the major changes to the agreement are in the area of rules of origin. And rules of origin are the requirements that essentially say whether a product can qualify for duty-free entry as part of the agreement. Some of the things that were the main focus of this were autos, textiles, chemicals, and steel-intensive products, as well as glass and optical fiber.
I mean, the details do get pretty granular. Tell me about the change to the sunset provision. What is the sunset provision and what's changed about it?
So originally, what the U.S. side had proposed was that after 5 years, the trade agreement would automatically expire unless all three parties agreed to continue it. So now what they've agreed to is that the trade agreement would be in effect for 16 years, and that after 6 years, they would review it to see whether they would continue for another 16 years. Now, if they don't get to some sort of agreement in that time period, let's say within the 16 years, there's a potential that the agreement could expire. Now, it's not clear without seeing the actual text of the agreement what would happen, but that appears to be the compromise solution for the sunset clause.
How significant would you say these changes are to what's contained in the original NAFTA deal? I mean, are they what you expected based on what President Trump has said in the past?
Well, I guess it depends chapter by chapter, and we'll know when we see the full text. So, for example, on like e-commerce, on labor and environment, it appears that what we see are similar things to what's in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement already. And that, I think, was no surprise to many people who are watching this. But in terms of strengthening rules of origin, which was sort of what President Trump said were the main things he was going to focus on, he really has made them tougher. So NAFTA is already one of the toughest rules of origin regimes of any trade agreement in the world, and they just got a lot more strict. And I think in that sense, the impact will be pretty severe, particularly for the auto industry, where that content requirement went from 62.5% regional content requirement for duty-free to 75% regional content requirement.
So that means like 75% of all the materials in a car have to come from the U.S. or Mexico.
That's exactly right. And there's an additional requirement that they put in, which is really a new provision that's never been in any U.S. trade agreement before. That is to say that 40 to 45% of that 75 has to be made from workers that make at least $16 an hour minimum wage. And that is something that we've never really seen before in a trade agreement. And it's really hard to tell what the impact of that's going to be, other than the fact that Mexico will be adversely affected by this.
In what way? Because they're now going to have to shell out $16 per hour for everybody working on that factory floor?
Pretty much. And they make roughly on average about half of that right now, whereas the U.S. and Canada already pay their auto workers at least 16 or above. And so they won't really be affected by this.
What details have not been worked out yet?
So the big question remains, what's going to happen with dispute settlement, which is basically where one of the countries can hold another to account for not meeting the obligations of the agreement. Ambassador Lighthizer said he wanted this to be non-binding. And if it's non-binding, it's hard to see how you would enforce the trade agreement at all. And I think that's going to be a major thing to watch out for this week.
I guess in terms of timing, there are two flowcharts here, one where there's a bilateral trade deal and another where there's a trilateral trade deal and Canada comes aboard. What does the timeline look like?
So right now we have a tight deadline this week in particular because Ambassador Lighthizer has said that he wants to give Congress a notice of intent to sign the deal. That starts a ticker for the signing of the current agreement within 90 days. So that takes us to the end of November where the U.S. and Mexico could possibly sign the new agreement. Now for a trilateral deal, it's hard to say exactly where that deadline might be other than before the U.S. and Mexico sign their own agreement.
What do you think the likelihood is of this moving forward without Canada and just being a bilateral deal with Mexico? And would it be effective?
I think it's certainly a possibility and we shouldn't rule it out. President Trump has made pretty clear that he's willing to go ahead as the bilateral and even charge Canada auto tariffs at 25% to force some sort of compromise if Canada doesn't cooperate. Would it be effective? I don't think so. When you think about the way that the three countries have integrated since NAFTA was put into effect, we have over $1 trillion of annual trade between the three partners. You know, if you think of it as like a supply chain running through the three countries, it's almost as if you're putting a wall up between the United States and Canada. And I think it would be very detrimental to all three countries if that occurred.
Inu Manak, a visiting scholar at the Cato Institute, thanks very much for explaining this to us.
Thank you for having me.
As we said, President Trump has implied he's ready to cut Canada loose if it does not get on board quickly. Canada's foreign minister, Chrystia Freeland, today cut short a trip to Europe to join talks in Washington in person. Specifically, Trump has said Canada must sign a new deal or face heavy tariffs on the cars they produce. Gordon Ritchie was one of Canada's chief negotiators in the original U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement, the precursor to NAFTA. That was back in the 1980s. Ritchie is actually optimistic about the talks.
I think there could be agreement in principle by this weekend. Now, working out some of the final details may take a fair bit more time, but if there is a political will, if the Americans are ready to pick up the deal that lies quivering on the table, this whole thing could be wrapped up by this weekend.
So the deal quivering on the table, or that deal is what essentially? Basically the old NAFTA with some modifications?
Well, I wouldn't say the old NAFTA. What it is the agreement to eliminate tariffs between the three countries, which is what the existing agreement does, with some additional rules on content, what constitutes a product that can travel freely across the borders, and a few other bits and pieces, some of which will be of interest to some people more than others. For example, the U.S. pharmaceutical industry makes an enormous effort to extend the patent monopolies it enjoys, and it appears there may be some movement on that as well. But the basic deal would be, as before, free cross-border trade for qualified products between all three countries. And by the way, I know Mr. Trump, when he gets some idea or somebody whispers something in his ear, especially from Fox News, it stays in there and it rattles around. But to make a big fuss about the Canadian dairy tariffs is really kind of foolish. I don't like
which he has done.
I don't like the Canadian program, but we're talking about less than a quarter of 1% of the two-way trade. Less than a quarter of 1%. And on that trade, by the way, the Americans are running a substantial surplus. And by the way, these terrible, terrible, terrible Canadian tariffs are no higher than the tariffs on some American sacred cows, if you'll forgive the pun, like tobacco and sugar. So one has to understand, Mr. Trump is almost completely disconnected from objective reality. He is, to be very blunt about it, he is appallingly ignorant, certainly in these trade matters. He doesn't know what he is talking about. So his negotiators have a very difficult task. But they're doing a good job of it, and I think they can probably pull this off.
your opinion may be that Donald Trump is ignorant, but I mean, if this plan works, I mean, does it matter?
Look, this isn't a matter of my opinion. Trump is criticized for being a pathological liar. I think that's a bit of a bum rap. I think he honestly doesn't know what the truth is in many cases, and he really doesn't attach much importance to it. He doesn't know a thing about international trade. He doesn't, for example, in that press conference that he had to announce this wonderful deal, virtually everything he said was factually wrong, including, by the way, that the big deal was with Mexico because trade with Canada is a much smaller sector. Well, that's just plain silly. I mean, Canada is by far the biggest customer for U.S. products in the world and the best customer. I mean, that's just one example. But everything he said was inaccurate. That doesn't make it any less dangerous. And, you know, poor Bob Lighthizer, I don't envy him, but he's got to
somehow— The U.S. trade representative.
Yeah, he's got to deliver this guy a win.
Gordon Ritchie, really appreciate your time. Thank you.
My pleasure.
That was Ambassador Gordon Ritchie, Canada's deputy chief trade negotiator in the 1980s. All sides are committing war crimes in Yemen. That is the bottom line from United Nations human rights investigators. In a report issued today, UN investigators said that both the Saudi-led coalition and Houthi rebels are guilty of killing Yemeni civilians. But they singled out the American-backed Saudi coalition for the deaths of thousands of civilians in airstrikes. They've died in bombing attacks on schools, hospitals, and markets. Investigator Charles Garraway said the report does not specify what percentages of civilian deaths were caused by each side, but he said there's been a clear pattern of violence against civilians.
We have covered the airstrikes by the coalition, detention by all parties, the shelling by the de facto authorities, the Houthis in Taiz, sexual violence, etc. We have therefore, in identifying patterns, not sought to identify any particular party that is more guilty than others. However, I think it's fair to say that we have, of those parties that we have investigated, and we have not been able to look at, for example, Al-Qaeda and Daesh, who are also involved in Yemen, of those parties, none have clean hands.
On Monday, Saudi Arabia accused the UN of bias for condemning two airstrikes that killed scores of Yemeni children and civilians early this month. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said the U.S. was still supporting the Saudi coalition in Yemen and working to end the conflict.
We are constantly reviewing what support we are giving, yes. We also had an Army Lieutenant General in Riyadh almost immediately following the early August tragedy. To convey our concerns and ask for a swift and complete investigation. And we will continue to do everything we can to limit this kind of tragedy. But the most effective way is to get this to a UN-brokered negotiation.
Mattis said U.S. support for the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen was in place before the Trump administration took over early last year. But he said it is still a U.S. priority. So is minimizing the number of civilians caught up in the violence.
We reviewed it. We determined that it was the right thing to do to support them in the defense of their own countries, but also to restore the rightful government. There is, in effect, what is going on. Our conduct there is to try to keep the human cost of innocents being killed accidentally to the absolute minimum. That is our goal where we engage with the coalition. In Yemen, as a general statement, we stay out of the war ourselves, and we are focused on defeating ISIS and Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. That's what we do where we conduct operations.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis speaking at a news conference today. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The U.S. Open kicked off last week in New York, and one of the favorites to win the tournament is 23-time Grand Slam winner Serena Williams. But over the weekend, Williams was in the news because of something else, the black bodysuit that she wore back in May during the French Open. Here's what she had to say about it back then.
I had a lot of problems with my blood clots, and God, I don't know how many I've had in the past 12 months. I've been wearing pants a lot in general when I play, so I can keep, you know, the blood circulation going. So it's a fun suit, but it's also functional, so I can be able to play without any problems.
So just to be clear, that's what Serena had to say about her cat suit back in May during the French Open. Pretty straightforward, fun, and it also helped Williams deal with blood clots from her pregnancy. So why are we talking about this again 3 months later? Ava Wallace covers sports for The Washington Post, and she joins us from New York. She's at the Media Center at Flushing Meadows. Ava, the French Open is behind us. Tell us why Serena Williams' bodysuit, some would say cat suit, has now resurfaced.
Yeah, so the president of the French Tennis Federation gave an interview in Tennis Magazine recently where he said that the French Open would be instating this dress code and that Serena Williams' cat suit that she wore this past May would be on the banned list next year. And something that he kind of followed up with was he said, you have to respect the time and place in the sport. So it wasn't just this issue of they didn't like the look. He brought in this whole issue of respect and implied that Serena's outfit would have been disrespectful to either the French Open or the sport or the fans, something along those lines.
Yeah, the French Tennis Federation president Giudicelli even said, I think that sometimes we've gone too far. Do you see this as another case? It's happened before where Williams is singled out.
Yeah, and it's kind of hard not to see it from that point of view. Her body, how she dresses, how she looks on court, how she acts on court has been something that's been discussed really throughout her whole career. The first thing that I thought of was when she was just kind of getting on court in the late 90s and early 2000s, and she and her sister Venus were singled out over the beads that they wore in their hair.
And then on Saturday at a press conference, Williams was asked about Giudicelli's statements. Let's hear what she said.
I don't know exactly what he seemed to say or what he didn't seem to say or what, but I we already talked. So like I said, we have a great relationship. So we talked yesterday and yeah, so it's everything's fine, guys.
So Ava, you attended the press conference. Were you surprised by Williams kind of distancing herself from those remarks?
Yeah, you never really know what you're going to get with Serena with things like this. She can either absolutely go off and delve into those issues of policing black bodies and not embracing different types of bodies on the tennis court. So she could either really delve into that, or the other 50% of the time, Serena shuts things down. And that's what she did on Saturday. She didn't necessarily invalidate any of the issues that were brought up around the cat suit. She was just saying everything's good here. And she also added that she's sure if she had a chat with the Grand Slams, if they realized that the suit was for health reasons, she was sure they would come to an understanding. It was almost kind of a power move against all of the other Grand Slams a little bit in that way.
Yeah, so when you say those comments don't invalidate any of the bigger issues here, I mean, tell us about what some of those bigger issues are.
Sure. I saw a lot of tweets online from people that I follow linking this issue to not letting NCAA athletes unionize and not letting NFL players kneel. It's just a way, people were saying, for officials in sports to have more control over the players. It was, of course, linked back to all of those discussions of Serena's body and how she looks on court. And it was kind of about sexism in tennis as well.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, some of the pushback came from Andy Roddick and Chris Evert and even from Nike itself.
Yeah, Nike and Serena's agent. She obviously said at the French Open, she related the cat suit back to it, made her feel like a warrior princess, like a queen in Wakanda, talking about the Black Panther movie that had just come out.
Right.
And then Nike tweeted, you can't take the superpowers away from the superhero. You can take her suit, you can't take the powers away.
So the French Open becoming a little bit like Wimbledon. I mean, in terms of dress, Wimbledon is white tennis togs only. Would Wimbledon accept a white cat suit?
I don't think Wimbledon, the French president said, I think sometimes we've gone too far. Wimbledon would definitely say that that's going too far.
Looking at the tennis, what are Serena Williams' chances for the U.S. Open this year?
Well, they got a lot better. The number one seed, Simona Halep, lost to the 44-ranked player in the world. She's actually the first top seed to ever lose in the first round at the U.S. Open.
Wow.
And she would have played Serena in the fourth round. So Serena's chances are looking better, I would say.
Ava Wallace covers sports for the Washington Post. She's been speaking with us from the Media Center at Flushing Meadows at the U.S. Open in New York. Ava, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Incidentally, one of the people who tweeted about Serena Williams' catsuit was none other than Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Yes, the former president of Iran. He wrote, "Why is the French Open disrespecting Serena Williams?" Yeah, apparently someone's got a lot of time on their hands. I wonder if Ahmadinejad has any opinions about quinceañera dresses, because my next guest, Natalia Garcia of Southern California, used Twitter to find a quinceañera dress for her friend Kayla. This all started when Natalia ran into Kayla's mom and they got to talking. You see, Kayla's mom had been battling cancer and the family didn't have a lot of extra money to spend on Kayla's party.
And she was kind of telling me how, you know, Kayla didn't necessarily want a quinceañera because she didn't want to inconvenience her mom, her dad, her family. And so it was just really, you know, it in my heart, I knew that this was something that I was meant to help out with.
And so Natalia sent out a tweet that said, "Hi, guys, if you have a quinceañera dress around size 14 that you are willing to donate, please let me know."
It really didn't, like, get super big at first. I think I had gone to bed and it was at, like, 8 retweets, and I was like, oh, like, look, it's like getting so much attention. I was actually so happy. And I woke up and my brother was like in my room and he was like, "Have you seen your tweet? It has like thousands of retweets." It was just, it had blown up. And so I had hundreds of people saying that they wanted to give away dresses, that they wanted to donate cash, that they wanted to give away photo albums that they didn't use, tiaras that they didn't use, shoes, makeup. People were offering services of all kinds.
Wow.
It was just so heartwarming to see.
So did you find a dress and did Kayla choose one?
We've actually found multiple dresses, believe it or not, because quinceañera is a very special moment for a girl. And a lot of times what we do is we have the big ball gown dress and then we change into like a little party dress for the night. And then you change back into the ball gown dress like when you're kind of at the end of the party. And so she's gotten big ball gown dresses. We actually just picked one up from a girl in Riverside. Her name is Rosario. So if she's listening, thank you very much. And then some boutiques reached out to Kayla as well. And they've given her dresses to change into throughout the night. They've actually even gifted her mom a dress. So
wow.
It's amazing.
So you did really good on behalf of Kayla and these dresses. Help us understand why it is so important for girls to go through the quinceañera whole ritual.
So just the quinceañera, it originates in Hispanic culture, but I think, you know, all cultures kind of deserve to have the, like, this coming of age thing. Look, it's your time to shine. It's this moment where a lot of the times we just kind of live in a world where we're just one piece of the puzzle and you get to be, you know, the center. You get to be the center of the world, or your world at least.
So Kayla, happy birthday and have a wonderful quinceañera. That was Natalia Garcia speaking with us from La Verne, California. I'm Marco Werman. When the French environment minister quit his job during a live radio interview, he took everyone by surprise, and I mean everyone.
Because he hadn't told the president or the prime minister beforehand, and he even told us during the interview that he hadn't told even his wife.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Listeners to France Inter, a national radio channel in France, got a big surprise earlier today. One second, they were listening to an interview with their country's environment minister, Nicolas Hulot. Next minute, the minister was resigning live on air.
Je vais prendre pour la première fois la décision la plus difficile de ma vie.
I'm going to make for the first time the most difficult decision of my life. I don't want to lie to myself anymore. I do not want to give the illusion that my presence in government means that we are up to the challenge. So I'm making the decision to leave the government today.
Live on air, Monsieur Hulot said he's calling it quits out of frustration over the lack of action on climate issues under President Emmanuel Macron. This is especially surprising given Macron's own pledge to be a leader on climate issues. You might recall his response to President Trump, "Make our planet great again," after Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Pierre Aski is a commentator for France Inter, and he was in the studio when Hulot announced his resignation.
Nicolas Hulot is a special character. He's not a politician. He's a longtime activist, TV star. He had for a long time a show on TV on environment issues. The fact that he accepted to be in government was already a big surprise because he had always resisted the temptation to go into politics. And for the past 18 months in Mr. Macron's government, he was uncomfortable. And all of a sudden, it came to a breaking point. And he made this very surprising announcement because he hadn't told the president or the prime minister beforehand. And he even told us during the interview that he had made up his mind the night before. He hadn't told even his wife.
Yeah.
And he decided during the show to announce it.
Yeah, I mean, even the interviewer was taken aback, kind of like, what did you just say?
Absolutely. It was very surprising because we had a coffee with him just before going into the live interview, and he was tense and a bit upset by some issues, but nothing that would let us think that a couple of minutes later he would announce his surprise resignation from government with a very emotional and dramatic tone.
So let's talk about what all this means, because as you said, Nicolas Hulot, he's not a politician, something of an environmental celebrity almost. President Macron courted him pretty aggressively. And after Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, Macron unveiled this campaign to make our planet great again. So what does this resignation actually tell us about just how aggressive Macron's environmental policies are?
If you listen to Nicolas Hulot, it just means that Emmanuel Macron, like most politicians in the world, is caught in this big contradiction between having to solve economic and social issues right now and taking the necessary measures to solve the climate issue tomorrow. And that's what Nicolas Hulot would not accept, especially after this summer where we had this heat wave. Nicolas Hulot says, if that's not the time where it is the absolute priority, when is the time?
Will the resignation of Hulot hurt Macron's image now as a climate leader?
Yes, definitely. I think it brings back this dilemma. Do we need a specific Green Party, or is every party today taking into account the climate and the environment issue? And probably Nicolas Hulot's resignation will bring back this debate, because he said, I was alone in government. I had no army behind me. I had no party. I had no members of parliament. And that's the weakness of the environment issue in politics today.
What's been reaction from environmental groups in France?
They paid tribute to Hulot's honesty for speaking his mind and not wanting to be any longer the kind of smiling face of the environment policy when there's no real hard substance behind it.
Pierre, does this episode tell us anything more generally about life in Macron's cabinet and inner circle?
Macron came as the new kid on the block, and he had a promise of reinventing politics with new people, civil society. One third of the members of his parliamentary group are civil society, people who had no previous political experience, and Nicolas Hulot was really kind of a flagship figure for that. What it tells us is how difficult it is to reinvent politics, because political rules have a way of coming back, reimposing themselves, including with new people.
Pierre Aski with Radio France Inter. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about the Koreas for the next few minutes. There was a lot of pomp and circumstance around the Trump-Kim summit back in June, but there was also a sense that the devil was going to be in the details. Soon after the summit, reports came out that North Korea was, in fact, not slowing down its nuclear activities. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo seemed to be staying the course. He has visited North Korea several times and met with Kim Jong-un himself. Last Friday, however, President Trump suddenly canceled what would have been Pompeo's fourth visit to the country. Soo Kim is a contributor for The Hill. She's also a former analyst with the CIA, specializing in East Asia, propaganda, and leadership studies. Soo Kim, why was this trip canceled?
So the trip was canceled because, as we found out, North Korea apparently sent the United States a very hostile letter expressing disgruntlement towards the lack of progress between Washington and Pyongyang, you know, over its denuclearization efforts. And the United States has not been seeing much progress on the part of North Korea, dismantling or coming clean on its nuclear weapons program. From the North Korean perspective, they don't see it as progress because they are not seeing reciprocated action from the United States in the negotiations.
So what reaction have you heard about this canceled visit from Pompeo from South Korea? And have you heard any reaction from North Korea?
Well, from South Korea, the South Korean government appears to be sort of on edge, because they want to see progress in inter-Korean relations and perhaps even relations between Washington and Pyongyang. for a Moon administration that is bent on producing some fruit with North Korea, that the fact that this big hurdle, which is, you know, the relationship between Washington and Pyongyang, is at a standstill, could actually negatively affect South Korea's engagement with Pyongyang.
There's high value placed on these meetings, but my understanding is Secretary Pompeo would not have actually met with the key players, Kim Jong-un specifically. Why meet for a fourth time? What was the strategy?
The purpose of Secretary Pompeo's trip, in my opinion, I think, as much as it's said in the public that they were hoping to get something concrete from North Korea, it was probably attributed to the fact that we have not seen any progress so far in our engagement with North Korea. So perhaps the trip would have been a gesture on Washington's part to show that we are serious about the relationship and we're serious about moving things forward. But at the same time, we do want to see, I would hope that we'd want to see something reciprocated by North Korea before we take another step forward in the engagement process.
Soo Kim, what worries you the most as things with North Korea move forward?
The most concerning thing is we don't seem to have a coherent, firmly grounded understanding of how the regime operates. We do have an understanding of who the players are, but it just seems like the cognitive understanding of the roots of North Korea, the existence, its motivations for coming to the table are understood by few key players. And we're not really willing to take a step back and to reassess, perhaps recalibrate our approach, which is it's dangerous, because if we continue these dual/multiple-track engagement efforts with North Korea without really securing anything on the part of North Korea, whether that's its nuclear weapons or perhaps taking a less hostile approach towards the United States or South Korea or the region, unless that is guaranteed, unless that is secured, it seems like it's not a reciprocated engagement, I would say.
Soo Kim writes for The Hill. She's also a former CIA analyst. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Even if things are tense now between Pyongyang and Washington, there's a general sense that a thaw could continue between the two Koreas, at least. And that's meant more tourists checking out the DMZ, the 150-mile-long demilitarized zone along the border. Reporter Stephen Nesson joined a tour from the South Korean side.
When I arrive at the entrance to the DMZ, it looks more like a theme park than a memorial to the war that divided the Korean peninsula. Pop music plays at a gift shop. There are bumper cars and another amusement, a giant boat that swings back and forth called the Super Viking. It's not what you'd expect after driving through an armed checkpoint where soldiers board the bus to inspect passports. And it's not the kind of place you'd normally go to pay respects to a living memorial to the Korean War. A war where 3 million soldiers and civilians were killed in a conflict that dragged on for 3 years. The first person I meet is Song Jong-hee. She's been working at this gift shop for 30 years. She sells jade tchotchkes, fake North Korean currency, and what is claimed to be actual ginseng liquor from the other side as well. A t-shirt in the shop reads, DMZ since 1953. Speaking through a translator, Song says since the historic meeting in April between South Korean President Moon Jae-in and North Korea's Kim Jong-un, tourist business here at the DMZ is booming. It turns out the prospect of peace is profitable.
Customers have increased thanks to the peace talks. Foreigners and Koreans alike.
There's two layers of barbed wire fence and prison-style guard towers dotting the landscape. Defectors from either side who attempt to cross here are typically shot. So this isn't exactly Disney World. Visitors can't just stroll into the DMZ. You need to buy a government-sanctioned package tour, and once you arrive at the main entrance, you're escorted to a bus. My bus is half filled with American journalists and international tourists from China and Europe. Some of them pick up a crunchy local snack before boarding and offer me a taste.
What is that? Silkworm?
I'm good, thanks. We drive up hills and witness an astounding array of flora and fauna. Because nobody's allowed to live in the DMZ, it's now home to rare birds, and even the Asiatic black bears can be seen on occasion lurking here. There are also thousands of landmines here left over from the war. We're led out of the bus and head over to a tunnel covered in a green awning. We climb into a roller coaster-like car on a track. As we descend underground, we get a history lesson.
Today, we can only explore 265 meters of the tunnel on foot, as a wall has been constructed to block the tunnel and prevent anyone from traveling further to the north.
The tunnel is cool, damp, and the ceiling is low, so you have to bend over while you walk. At 5 feet 7 inches, I bump my head at least 3 times.
Oh, hit my head again. More gas masks.
The word is, this tunnel was built for 30,000 North Korean soldiers to launch an invasion against their enemies in the south. We're allowed to walk to the end of the South Korean side of the tunnel. It's boarded up, but there's a small window you can peer through to the other side. But you can't see much. We're ushered above ground and brought into a theater. Every visitor to the DMZ is required to watch this video.
The world's only demilitarized zone, DMZ, is a place that bears the tragedy of the time and the past.
The scenes of explosions and newsreel footage of crying families and dead bodies is a reminder of the South's tense relationship with the North. But the film's message is also that not that long ago, this was one nation, and could be again.
Korea has overcome the pain of war and achieved miraculous economic growth. And another miracle that we must achieve as we pursue harmony and coexistence, unification.
Okay, come on, girl. Let's go forward.
Before leaving the DMZ, we stop at its train station, which looks like a Hollywood set. The Dorasun station opened in 2014 and is bright and airy with a bustling gift shop. One train arrives from Seoul every day. This is the northernmost stop on the line, for now. Posted on the wall here is a giant map of a route that doesn't exist, from Seoul through North Korea to China and on to Russia. As guards in black helmets and camouflage stand at attention, tourists are taking pictures in front of a sign that reads "To Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea." One after another, the visitors pose in front of the Pyongyang sign and make a heart shape with their fingers as the picture is taken. Kim Cho-long just finished taking pictures here. The 29-year-old says many Koreans believe unification is possible.
요즘에 들어서 남북 관계가 좋아지기도 했고 그런
We wanted to feel the good mood that is going on between South and North Korea these days, so we wanted to come here to feel the mood and learn lessons.
Tourists from China and Russia have reportedly been flooding North Korea to get a glimpse of the DMZ from that side. But earlier this month, the North's leader, Kim Jong-un, blocked all tourist visas until after the 70th anniversary celebration of his country's birth. And after that, another round of talks between the North and South are scheduled, possibly bringing the nations a little bit closer to each other. For the world, I'm Stephen Nesson.
Multiple times a day, every month, for approximately 30 years, half the world's population needs sanitary pads and tampons. They are not cheap, and some women and girls have serious challenges when they can't afford them. This past Friday, Scotland decided to offer free sanitary napkins to students, reportedly the first country to do so. One of the activists behind this move is Victoria Heaney. She's a member of Women for Independence, a grassroots group in Scotland. I asked her about her research on period poverty that caught the Scottish government's attention last year.
The special thing about the research is that it's groundbreaking. It's never been done before. So we decided to do a little bit of digging, ask some questions. And before we knew it, we had the biggest evidence-based research that the Western world has seen in regard to this topic. So it's been pretty phenomenal.
And what did the research show? I mean, like, how bad is the problem for girls who menstruate during the school year?
Well, we had found that a lot of people who couldn't afford period products had decided to, you know, not attend school. We also found as well that sometimes the problem wasn't actually about money. Sometimes the problem actually came in the shame of asking someone as well. So that depended on how your relationship with your family was and how comfortable you are as a woman talking about your body and talking about having a visible period in public too. And the one thing the research pointed to was that after women having trouble accessing products because they couldn't afford them, the biggest and most common insight experience was stigma and shame. And this was women feeling ashamed, feeling dirty, feeling unhygienic, and not actually feeling like they can access everything in society when they're on their period due to just the stigma that goes hand in hand with it.
So walk us through, Victoria, what this will look like at schools, colleges, and universities. Like, how will students have access to these products when they get their period?
Well, what it's going to look like, the research has indicated that over 22% of the people that took part in the survey have actually missed school, they've missed work, they've missed appointments. So hopefully this provision is now going to start enabling students, but without the stigma or the shame of having to ask someone. So these will be dispensed, they'll be freely available, and you won't have to, you know, feel like you're in the 70s and asking the nurse for a tampon or for a pad when you come on.
You know, I got to say, when I first heard about this story, I was kind of surprised that it was happening in Scotland, fairly wealthy country. I mean, I covered an almost identical story in a slum in Nairobi, Kenya. Girls who could not afford sanitary pads and tampons ended up missing school, sometimes actually having to drop out because of something as banal as their period. Personally for you, what was your own awareness of this problem in Scotland? And were you surprised to hear how consequential things can be for schoolgirls during menstruation?
What we've all found is that there's a dangerous myth that access to period products only affect certain countries or, you know, certain demographics or, you know, countries with a certain economic type of output too. But I think what we've seen is then that most Western countries are experiencing austerity. They're experiencing, you know, cutbacks when it comes to social provision too. So there's this myth that these situations don't happen on our doorstep, but they're actually happening to the women down the street as well.
So in Scotland, what work still needs to be done?
Well, there's always work that we've done as well. But I think right now we need to celebrate, you know, our success of this fact. We need to celebrate that our country has become a world leader. And we also need to celebrate the fact that we have people in every pocket of society who are listening to these organisations, they're listening to campaigners. But I think pushing forward, there's lots more we need to do in terms of education. Biological education, it has to match up with how a woman sees her place in the world and how society views and treats women too. So I think we've still got a lot of normalisation to do when it comes to how we talk about periods, how we act around them, and how we talk to boys and men about them too. We all need to be educated on the same level about this.
Victoria Heaney is a member of the Scottish grassroots group Women for Independence. Her research helped lead to Scotland's decision to battle period poverty in schools by offering free sanitary products to students. We've got colleagues at our London office who report for BBC Great Lakes. They don't focus on Lakes Michigan, Superior, and Huron. No, their patch is that part of East Africa that includes Lakes Victoria and Tanganyika and the countries of Rwanda and Burundi. Robert Misigaro is with BBC Great Lakes. He comes from Bujumbura, the capital of Burundi, and he's been reminiscing about one street and a building that were important to him growing up.
The street that means a lot to me is the 11th Street, or 11th Avenue in French, which is the street where I grew up. But the building, actually, it's a bit further away. It's a youth center called Centre Jeune Kamenge. That's where basically my life totally transformed. And if it wasn't for that youth center, I wouldn't be where I am today. As a teenager growing up, when I was around 13 or 14, there was a war in Burundi, and Kamenge was one of those areas. Kamenge is the area where I grew up in Bujumbura anyway. It was one of those areas that were very affected by the war. There were, you know, shootings like every day almost. The conflict was when the first elected president in Burundi was killed, Melchior Ndadaye, in 1993. His supporters decided to fight the army, which, you know, they claimed was responsible for his death. So it started quite sporadically in areas like where I grew up. People started to arm themselves to fight the army, which turned into a big rebel group, which is the actual ruling party now came through that movement. Us, you know, having that youth center was this kind of island of peace where we could escape and go and do whatever any teenager can do, play football, play music, and forget about all those other troubles. The first day I went there and enrolled for a guitar lesson, for me it was like a dream come true, because most people grew up in Africa, they wouldn't understand. To be able to find an instrument to play, you either have to be a member of a church or have someone who's really well connected. So that place, you know, being able to go there and learn how to play an instrument, it was a bonus to me. I loved music, but I couldn't have ever dreamed of being able to actually, you know, play music. So for me, it was almost a dream.
As he said, it was an island of peace that let him find mental refuge from the war. My colleague Robert Misigaro there with BBC Great Lakes, recalling growing up in the capital of Burundi, Bujumbura, and learning to play the guitar. We leave you today with some more guitar sounds from Burundi, this from the 1970s and the band Africa Nova. How I managed to track down this song, it's a long story, but a good one. We'll save that for another time. That is our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.